academic. You were made as well as we could make you.
But not to last.
The light that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And you have burned so very, very brightly, Roy.
Hello, and welcome to 80s Movie Montage. This is Derek.
And this is Anna.
And that was Roy looking for a more positive customer service experience with Mr. Tyrell. It did not go well for Mr. Tyrell.
No, that was quite the extended head-crushing scene.
Of course, from 1982's Head Crusher. No, Blade Runner.
I thought we were in an episode of Game of Thrones, but
yeah,
it really gives that scene a run for its money.
It was pretty much identical. We did watch the final cut, so maybe they had an extended version of the head-crushing scene.
I mean, we were just thinking, wow, there's so much to crush, because I just kept hearing breaking bone,
yeah,
breaking skull. So, yes, Blade Runner.
So in that scene, I'll just say real quickly, yeah, in that scene, as literally every other scene where one of the replicants is killing someone,
mm-hmm,
their facial expressions,
yeah,
wow,
they get crazy.
Crazy.
I mean, that
very intense.
That had to have been intentional direction, I'm
yeah,
guessing.
To show just how, like, not just like an effort, but
I mean, I was thinking about that when we were watching it. I felt like maybe Scott's direction for them to kind of have those facial expressions when they're in the act of killing is to show in that moment the lack of humanity, maybe.
Yeah.
Even though I feel like overall the film is incredibly sympathetic to the replicants. But
the plight of the replicants, yeah.
Yeah, but I feel like in that moment, because all of them do it. All of them do it. Especially Zora when she's trying to murder Deckard. Like her, it's, I mean, I feel like, again, it has to be intentional direction because it's so over the top. It feels like, I'm not saying that it was bad acting, but it's so exaggerated.
No, I don't
think
it was
bad. It's like Jim Carrey exaggerated.
I don't think it was bad at all. I think it was definitely deliberate just
yeah,
because every replicant
yes,
followed that same,
yes,
that same process when,
yeah,
yeah.
So, Blade Runner.
Blade Runner.
Finally doing this one. This season, we're catching up with a couple films that we've talked about, like, in passing quite a bit, but just never got around to doing.
I like to think of Blade Runner as the ordinary people of sci-fi.
I'm not sure if that's... I have no idea if you're saying that in a positive way or a negative way. I really don't know.
It's there's just a lot of feelings, a lot of complicated
stuff. They're all in their feels. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Okay. So before I kind of go down the list, even though at the time, like, I don't know how much we're really going to get into. I think it's pretty well known that the film wasn't really well received when it first came out.
It did not create a box office bonanza.
It didn't. But it did get some Oscar attention.
Yeah.
And so because the two categories for which it was nominated, we don't really cover the individuals who are part of those departments. It got a Best Art Direction Set Decoration Oscar nomination.
Yeah, I could see that.
Very well deserved, yeah.
It didn't win it?
It did not win. Hmm. It only was nominated. It didn't win either.
Okay.
And then do you want to take a guess what the other one was?
Music?
No, but that wouldn't have been a bad guess.
No, I can't.
Best Effects Visual Effects.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So both of those make a lot of sense.
But
yeah,
it didn't win either one of those.
No.
What? I don't want to put you on the spot.
Oh my gosh, you're totally putting me on the spot. I'm going to let you take a look.
Yeah.
Because you're...
I'll look while we're...
Yeah. Well, it would have been, just to keep in mind, it would have been...
Well, 1982, right?
It would have been at the 1983 Academy Awards ceremony. It's always really confusing because I understand why they use that nomenclature, because yes, the actual ceremony takes place the year after the films that they're celebrating.
Yeah.
But it's confusing because they're celebrating the films of the year prior.
Yeah.
So anyway. All right.
Well,
yes.
You know,
did we get some answers here?
It may have been E.T.
Oh, sure. Actually, I think it came out in, if not the same weekend, real close proximity to E.T., which is in part why it was not... to say it wasn't received well, I mean, that doesn't always coincide with, like, poor box office. But I mean, it often can, but, you know, if you're going up against E.T., that's tough for any film. Yeah.
So. I mean, if I'm looking at the, if I look at the right year, I pulled up the 1983 Oscars,
mm-hmm. Okay.
which should have done it, but you know, the Oscar there. Yep. There you go. We've confirmed it.
For both categories?
Well, for visual effects, okay. E.T. won.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
What about best art direction?
Best art direction.
Would have been...
This is riveting films. Content right now.
We got off track real fast.
Marvel with me scrolling through a webpage that you can't see me do.
Well, while you're looking for best art direction...
Oh, you know what? What if I told you it was not E.T. because E.T. wasn't even nominated for art direction... What if it was that movie that everyone thinks of when you first think of art direction, Gandhi?
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that did win Best Picture that year. Yeah. So.
You know who else was nominated? Annie.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Victoria.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would have loved to have seen either one of those two. Win.
Blade Runner really stood out in these categories. Yeah. It was nominated for.
Yeah. I think I was kind of overlooked, but mm-hmm. In any case. So 1982, as we have said a couple times at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Writing credits. So I think also for anyone somewhat familiar with this movie, they are aware already of the source material from which this film was made. So famous novelist Philip K. Dick,
mm-hmm.
Big personality, big character throughout his life. He passed away before the film was even released. So he did not get to see this in its entirety.
It must have just been because he passed away in 1982.
Yeah. Right? What I read is that he got to see like a 20-minute clip of it. So from what I've read, he was happy with it. So hopefully they did his material justice.
Well, decades later, people are still trying to wonder what the hell is going on in a lot of it, so he must have been very happy about that.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we talked about this as we were watching it, that liberties were taken both by the screenwriters, by sure. Ridley Scott, so things change.
They always do.
From source material to yeah. final film.
Yeah.
But, and I think even initially, they were going to go with the, because the name of his novel is not Blade Runner.
It's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think at some point they were going to go with that title and they decided to.
You know what? Blade Runner does sound.
I like Blade Runner.
Sounds a lot cooler.
Yeah, it does sound a lot cooler. Although, I mean, great novel title. I think it's a great title.
Two for Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, please. Or two for Blade Runner.
Yeah. So. You know, because he was born in like 28, died in 82. So.
Wow.
Yeah. What? Wow.
I just like the
oh, the flipping flip of the yeah. yeah. I think he would have appreciated that too.
Yeah.
But because of that, much of his success came after his death in terms of adaptations of his work.
Okay.
So, but some of the other films that have come out, because if you go to his IMDb, he, like, unlike, you know, other writers like, you know, Stephen King, who has taken a stab at screenwriting, just all of his credits are, you know, him being noted
based on a novel.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So another one, Total Recall.
Man, it is a tragedy that is 1990.
Do you want to know what the material, like the title of that? Because it's not Total Recall.
What was it?
It's another really great title.
Yeah.
We Can Remember It For You Wholesale.
Okay.
Is the name of
that,
the material.
Yeah, that ties yeah. together more than Electric Sheep, possibly, but.
They kind of went with his titles for the remaining films, though. So Minority Report, Paycheck, A Scanner Darkly, and The Man in the High Castle.
Okay.
So moving on to the credited screenwriters, from what I could sense, it wasn't a collaboration. It was like this one guy took a stab at it, and then another guy, it was handed off to him to try to kind of polish it, perhaps.
Also stabbed it. Okay.
So first we have Hampton Francher. And actually what's really interesting is when I went to his IMDb, I was like, why does he look so familiar? He's way more credits as an actor than as a screenwriter.
Huh.
So I'm not quite sure how this came together in terms of him being a screenwriter for this film, but... And I mean, it's his first writing credit. So, like, somebody gave him a chance.
Someone's like, hey, do you want to adapt mm-hmm. this, Electric Sheep novel.
Yeah. So, I'm not. I mean, he has a lot of work as an actor, a lot of TV work specifically. I'm not going to go down that because that's not how he participated in this film. But among a couple of his other writing credits, not a lot, but we have The Mighty Quinn, and then also Blade Runner. Of course, Blade Runner 2049. So.
All right.
Okay. Okay. So moving on to actually, and throughout the course of this particular episode, we have a lot of people coming back to the podcast, so to speak.
Really?
In terms of people we've already talked about.
Oh, okay.
So one of the more recent ones is the other screenwriter for this, David Webb Peoples.
Okay.
So we talked about him just last fall when we covered...
Lady Hawk?
Yeah, another Rutger Hauer movie.
That's right.
Yeah, so...
He's so good in everything.
Yeah. It is really funny that we're already... I mean, I mentioned this, not to jump around too much, but when we were talking about Lady Hawk, I mentioned that, like, so many of Hauer's credits come later in his career. So there's not... It's not like there's nothing else to cover from him from the 80s, but it is funny that in such quick succession we're covering two of his films from the 80s.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Anyway, back to Peoples. So Lady Hawk, again, not like a really extensive filmography, but he is Oscar nominated. So he got Best Original Screenplay. I know you love this movie, Unforgiven.
Well, I just, it's not just me that loves that movie. It won an Academy Award for Best Picture.
It did.
A lot of people really enjoyed that movie. And I think the secret to it, I think the secret to so many people liking it is how good of a movie it is.
I'm not trying to disparage it. Sorry. It's sensitive.
I think I have a better shot. I have a better shot at getting you to watch The Godfather Part 3 than Unforgiven. And I don't know why.
Look, I have just... Tangentially, is that the word?
You've been present.
Yes, exactly, because you watch it a lot.
That's fair. Because if I randomly had Godfather 3 on, you would actually, like, I'm going for a walk.
Yeah, I would leave the room. But I've seen, probably all in all, with the number of times you've watched Unforgiven, I've probably seen it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so in any case, he's also the screenwriter on Hero and 12 Monkeys.
Okay.
So... Okay, very familiar director to probably anybody who loves movies, even in a very tiny sense. Everybody,
sure.
Everybody loves, knows, maybe they don't love, but they should, Ridley Scott. He's a fantastic director. I mean, if you actually go to his IMDb, he does have more producing credits than directing credits. You know, he, like, champions other people's works as well, but really well-known director. It's kind of astonishing that he hasn't won yet. He's been nominated several times, but he's never won Best Director.
I am actually surprised by that.
It's tragedy.
Yeah.
I mean, arguably, I would say that, like, well, I don't know. I mean, throughout his career, he's had some really great films. I was about to say that, like, I think some of his earlier work would have more so warranted that. I mean, I think it's ridiculous that he got no attention for Alien, but that's just...
That's because the Academy doesn't care about horror.
That's the plight of horror. Just,
like, and it was doubly screwed because it's like, oh my god, it's sci-fi horror? What is this garbage?
Yeah. So, that to me, like, that's again why I really kind of, like, my opinion of the Oscars and what they choose to... acknowledge doesn't mean much to me anymore. But in any case, so yes, of course he is the director of Alien. Oh, just missed that one. 79, can't do it. So, but we did do Legend.
When we're, look, one day when we're like, are we just gonna, we're just gonna do like a series of all the movies that were close but didn't really land in the 80s. We're going to do that one time.
We did have one of our favorite returning guests lobby hard to do what was technically a 1990 film.
It's true.
And they were like, but it was in production in 89, which, you know, that's a slippery slope. But if we had like a dedicated episode to On the Cusp movies or something like that.
Either way, either we can just find a way to break our own rules, Or no. I'm going to welcome everyone to Derek's 70s movie groove. I'll do it myself.
You do that voice that you do, though. We're like, hey, welcome to Derek's 70 movie groove. You do that voice.
I think I'll need to work on that voice.
Anyway, he did Legend, which we also did for this podcast, with, in fact, the same guest as Lady Hawk, one of our favorite people, Andrew. So go check that one out.
Music was an emphasis in both of those movies for different reasons and to varying levels of success.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Alien was 79, and then his first... which I think the reason why I reference that again is because I do think he should have gotten some Oscar attention for it. But the first time he gets a nomination is for, I believe it's 91, Thelma and Louise.
Yeah, let's just keep going.
So, yeah, let's just keep going. So, is a great movie. Did amazingly well for helming a film that really is...
What an interesting filmography.
Very much so.
From Alien, Legend, to Thelma and Louise.
Well, I remember talking about this when we talked about Legend, is that as I go throughout the course of his films, like, just the pendulum swing between, like, these really critically acclaimed... I mean, look, that's what cinema is. Like, he gets some hits, he gets some misses.
Yeah.
But he really swings heavy between really great films and...
And then he kind of went like full on George Lucas with all the Alien prequels.
Yeah. I mean, I'll definitely get to that. But so after Thelma and Louise, we have 1492, Conquest of Paradise, G.I. Jane.
Mm-hmm. Don't mention that. Oh, wait. No, that was Will Smith who just.
I think we're safe.
Yeah. Okay.
I think we're safe.
I just get nervous when it even comes up now.
So he goes from G.I. Jane to his next, like, Oscar-nominated directing gig, Gladiator.
Yeah, I'm surprised I didn't win.
Right?
They didn't win anything?
Won Best Picture.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Best Director. Can't get it all, man.
Which is like, look, I'm not saying that...
That's like a soft Best Director. Because like, you're like, I made it. Best Picture.
Yes. I mean, like, I think that it's a common circumstance that... Whoever wins Best Director, often the film goes on to win Best Picture. I don't think that should be a guarantee. So I'm not saying that like he automatically should have won, but I think this definitely would have been a film to warrant that.
Yeah.
So that again is something maybe you could do some research. So that film was 2000. I don't know who won 2000 or Best Director for
2021 for the 2000.
Wouldn't be 2021, it would be 2001.
My goodness.
Yeah, I know. See, this is what I'm saying. It gets really confusing fast. So then after Gladiator, he does Hannibal.
Oh, yeah.
Which did not need to be made, but
no,
okay.
It didn't, because I think, wasn't Hannibal basically, like, there was an earlier story to Silence of the Lambs. It was called Manhunter.
Sure, yeah.
It was like the movie Manhunter.
Yeah.
And Hannibal Lecter was in that, so I don't, they're not the same movie, but it was just...
Look, I don't want to take away, like, I mean, this movie's 20 years old, so it's all fine. But, like, I wouldn't want to take away jobs from people or, you know, the opportunity for people to carry out their livelihoods. But to me, it felt exploitive. Like, first of all, you don't get Jodie Foster back. As much as I love What's-Her-Face, like, you know, Jodie Foster was just so iconic as Clarice that, like, to have anybody else do it would be weird.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the scene with Ray Liotta, like, did that... we have to see somebody eating their own brain? Like,
it didn't bother me that much. It's fine.
I don't know what that says about you, but...
I don't know what it says about me, but I do know that Traffic, Steven Soderbergh,
won
Best Directing. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Now, people, I think, had thoughts about that at the time, too.
About that whole movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Well, and then he goes from Hannibal to Black Hawk Down, for which he got another Best Director Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
So far, that's the last Best Director nomination he's received. He did produce, like I've mentioned, he does, and got a Best Picture Oscar nom. I'll get to that one in a second. But he goes from Black Hawk Down to American Gangster, Robin Hood, not the Kevin Costner.
It's the Russell Crowe one, right?
Yeah.
He just likes Russell Crowe.
They work together a lot. Yeah. Yep. And here we go. So then he goes back to the Alien franchise and he does Prometheus, mm-hmm. which I'm pretty sure I said this last time we talked. You and I were so excited to go see that movie.
Yeah. And then by the time it was over, I'm like, that was nonsense.
Yeah.
That was just a bunch of nonsense.
Pretty quickly out the gate, not happy.
Yeah. No,
with
that
film.
God.
Yeah.
And the other one, what was the next one? Covenant?
Yes.
Covenant was somehow worse with two Michael Fassbenders fluting at each other.
It was a worse movie.
Very competitive.
If you forced me to watch one again, I would watch Prometheus.
Yeah. We hate watch them.
Prometheus gives you the origin story of the creators or whatever called.
Yeah.
But Covenant is just, and look, Michael Fassbender is amazing, but he can't even save that movie.
It's unsavable.
And then in between those two is when he does The Martian.
Yeah,
so he directs it, and then he produced on that, so that got an Oscar nom. And then more recently, he's done House of Gucci just this past year, 2023, Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've said before, I don't typically mention films that haven't been released, but this one's in post. It's, gonna come out, Gladiator 2. So.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so moving on to cinematography, somebody that we have talked about very recently. We're not too far along in this season, and we've already talked about him.
Okay.
Jordan Cronenweth. Weth? Yeah?
Yeah, I think that works, yeah.
Cronenweth?
Yeah.
So, he had a sizable filmography. He's no longer with us. But some of his credits, I remember bringing this up because I was like, oh, this would be interesting to watch Gable and Lombard. So presumably about Clark Gable and Carol Lombard.
Mm-hmm.
Altered States, Cutter's Way, Best Friends. So here we go. Very first film of the season. Peggy Sue Got Married.
Mm-hmm.
He was the DP on that. And he did get an Oscar nomination for his work on it. So that, and then also if you look through his filmography, especially, I think, a little bit later in his career, which is interesting because a lot of film directors do music videos earlier in their career, like David Fincher and that sort of thing. But he actually came to it a little bit later once he had already been established. But he did music videos for, U2, Madonna, Michael Jackson, so.
That must be, an 80s thing, maybe a 90s thing where we see that because I don't – is anyone making music videos now?
I mean, that's a great question. I don't know if is anybody making music videos? Is anybody watching?
Because if I go on MTV.
Where do you watch them? YouTube, I guess?
Yeah. If I go to MTV, first of all, someone should ask me, why are you going to MTV? And secondly, we all know that I'm just going to watch Rob Dyrdek's Ridiculousness because that's all that's on.
Such a shame.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Such a shame what happened to MTV. But okay, moving on to music. So this is there's a term for the people like Madonna or like Beyonce or Cher where they just go by the one name.
Yeah.
I don't remember off the top of my head, but this gentleman narcissist? Does the same thing. Dang. Oh.
is that the word?
Dang. Danky. not the one I was trying to think of.
It's a word.
So Vangelis is his first name.
Okay.
And the reason why I presume maybe he dropped off his second name, so it appears he's of Greek heritage, so it's a rather long surname. So I don't know if that's why he dropped it off. But so he just passed away. I mean, I guess to some people 2 years ago isn't just passed away, but he only passed away in 2022.
Wow.
And so he was the composer on this film and does have some very notable credits among his filmography. So I love this first film. I just had to put it in because it's a fun title. Do You Hear the Dogs Barking?
Every day.
So I thought that one was fun.
I think his last name was Papa Thanasio.
There you go. Yeah.
That's the best I could do.
Yeah. So for whatever reason, he kind of went by his first name only. But his big hit, so to speak, and truly iconic score, Chariots of Fire.
Oh, he did that.
He did that.
Okay.
And he won the Oscar for it, too.
Yeah, I'm not even going to look to see what else was there because I'm just going to assume that was probably the best thing.
Super iconic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, even when we, I don't know if they could do it outright because of copyright, but like when we covered Mr. Mom.
Yeah, there's
and they did like a
like
version
a,
of it.
Like, not even a parody, just like a, like, you know, like great value version of Chariots
yeah,
of Fire.
Yeah, like a Muzak yeah. version yeah. of it. Yeah.
Kirkland Chariots
exactly,
of Fire.
Exactly, exactly. So he, that is probably what most people would remember him for, understandably. And I just have also... All film credits for him.
I had no idea that he was the composer for Blade Runner, and for some reason I thought the same music, it was Tangerine Dream that did...
I could see why you would think that.
That did Legend, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was like a similar vibe.
Yeah, I could totally see that. He did Missing, The Bounty, Vampire in Venice, which I think that'd be a fun movie to watch.
Yeah.
He did 1492... Conquest of Paradise. So he reteams with Scott. He does the film Alexander. And then his final credit was a film called Nuclear Now.
Sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. film editing. This is such an interesting circumstance here. So I'm not sure what was going on in this situation because we rarely see this. We have not that we don't see two people credited, but rarely do I see editor and then a supervising editor credited in the category. But that's what we have here. Now, if you actually like click into their names, the reason being why they have that, I presume, is because Marsha Nakashima, who is the credited editor, she only has two credits total.
Okay.
For editing.
All right. This is one of them.
And the other credit is as an assistant editor.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
And it was for a TV movie called Aunt Mary. So that's all we have for her. However, for the supervising editor, who also, and a lot of people pull double duty with this, he was like, you know, what you would think of as a traditional film editor. So he's cutting the visuals for a film, but also he's a sound editor.
Okay.
Terry Rawlings.
Oh.
And yeah, I mean, he did a ton. He's no longer with us, but did a ton of great work. He was the editor on Alien. So.
Okay.
I don't know what, and it's not the first time we brought him up because he also did Legend.
So he had the thing going with Ridley Scott.
Yeah. So I don't know if they brought on Marsha and it wasn't working out or something and they brought Terry in, or if that was the plan all along. I have no idea.
You know what he worked on before Alien? Watership Down. So honestly, after that fucking horror show, Alien was probably a lot, like, pretty mellow.
I don't know the story behind Watership Down.
Watership Down, I think, is that, isn't it the animated story about rabbits? And these rabbits are fucking terrifying.
Oh.
They get in, like, these bloody rabid fights where, like, as a kid, you're watching these rabbits tear each other to pieces.
I feel like you're telling me about this for some reason.
Yeah, it's okay. Wild. It is a wild ride.
Okay.
Yeah.
Crazy. So... he was the editor on Alien. I have far more credits for him. He also worked on Chariots of Fire.
Okay.
And he got a Best Editing Oscar nomination for it. He did Yentl. Already mentioned, he was the editor on Legend. He does Not Without My Daughter, Alien, Not Without My Daughter. I say that.
It's like the flagship title for like Lifetime movies or something.
Yeah. And for some reason, I always say it in the same voice that Harrison says, get off my plane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even no, though, without my daughter.
Yeah, exactly. He cut Alien 3, GoldenEye, The Saint, U.S. Marshals, Entrapment, and then his final credit was The Phantom of the Opera.
And then he also edited something that we were probably going to potentially maybe cover one of these days, 1986's FX.
We were going to do that?
We might possibly.
This is a conversation we've had?
I think sure. So.
Okay. All right. Cool. All right, moving on to the stars of this film. A lot of heavy hitters.
Yeah.
So many big names. And many of them people we've already talked about. So
exactly.
At this point, it's bound to happen. I'm trying to think, though. I think it's actually last fall. So, of course, Harrison Ford is the first person that we're going to bring up. He is Deckard. I mean, you tell me how much you want to go down the rabbit hole today of whether or not Deckard was a replicant.
Like Scott, I think, has said that he believes he was, and the final cut includes this like dream that he has of a unicorn mm-hmm. that is supposed to support that theory. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if the final cut you see like in the reflection of the replicant's eyes.
Right.
You see like a little like
that's very
flare.
Intentional. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you see it for the briefest of moments yes. with Harrison Ford when he's talking to Rachel.
Correct.
But in the actual source material, he is not. And I feel like that's just too big of a change to make. And I don't think it's supported in the sequel, in Blade Runner 2049.
I don't think it is either. I mean, it's Scott's prerogative. I would say if he wants to differently interpret the story, although Dick does, like, the whole point with Deckard being a human in the novel is because, you know,
if they're all replicants, it's like,
yeah, if they're all replicants, then what the heck? But, yeah. You know, it's for him to learn humanity from non-humans. Yeah. Like that is the whole point of it.
Yep.
So that's kind of all taken away. I mean, I guess it is a like, oh, he's a replicant too. Like the fun kind of realization, but I think it kind of then diminishes the greater thematic value of the film.
It's fine, I think, particularly in the first one, for it to be like this ambiguous kind of like not really sure, because mm-hmm. it makes you think a little bit more about all the characters and mm-hmm. their personalities and how they interact. But I ultimately don't need it to be that. And I think in the sequel, isn't it that Harrison Ford, like Deckard and Rachel do end up having,
yes.
like she is able to conceive yes. his child?
Yeah.
So I think that means a lot more if it's a human and a replicant. Two replicants like, having offspring, that feels like it's a different kind of story.
Yes, yeah. And, I mean, to be honest, the thing that I would be more interested in discussing is, like, why were replicants even made to be so human-ish?
Yeah.
Like, if all they were ever going to be was essentially slave labor,
why do we just
why put that much effort into it?
Let's have, like, a bunch of, what, T-1000?
Yeah, no, but honestly, like, they put so much work into making them be as human as possible. Why?
I would say they tried to make them more human than human because that, in fact, was Tyrell Corp's motto.
And again, coming back to the question, why? Why was that necessary? Especially if all these issues are going to come up with replicants, like, wanting to live longer and thinking that they are human. And, like, you had to have known that it was eventually going to get to that point. So why set yourself up for that?
You're asking interesting questions. I do not have the answers.
Anyway, Harrison Ford. Gosh, every time I look at his filmography, I'm just like,
it's crazy.
The number of films that he's part of that billions of people just like love. And like, we're, you know, I think he recently got like a Lifetime Achievement Awards at one, like we're in the award circuit right now. We're a week out from the Academy Awards at the time of this recording. And so Academy Awards is like the final of the awards during like basically the first two and a half months of the year. Hmm. And he, I don't know which one it was, with a SAG, I don't know. But he got like a Lifetime Achievement Award. And I think he actually, you know, for as like curmudgeonly as people kind of joke about him being, I think he was like legitimately touched by it. And talk about well-deserved. I mean, I know that a lot of the films that he's part of skew more towards like, often it's used as a derogatory term, but like popcorn movies, you know?
But then there are some like presumed innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely mm-hmm. not just a pop. I mean, there's
no,
some...
no, he has done, you know, serious work really, really well. Like he is, I think, a great actor. All to say again, I don't think it means much if you don't have an Oscar sitting in your house. So in any case,
he should have at least a couple.
I wish he did. I wish he would, you know, get that kind of recognition as well, even though that's kind of a hypocritical statement for me to say 2 seconds later. But so early work, of course, American Graffiti, that's kind of how he begins his collaboration with George Lucas. Mm-hmm. He's also in The Conversation, which begins, I mean, not an ongoing collaboration, but he's in a couple of Coppola films. So that's one of them. Of course, the first of his, like, iconic characters is Han Solo in A New Hope. Mm-hmm. Between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, which we covered last fall with Krishna.
That's right.
So go check that one out. And that also happened to be our 100th episode.
That was a good one.
That was a good one.
That was a good one to do number 100 for.
Yes, yeah. So go check that one out. But in between the two Star Wars films, he does Apocalypse Now. So that's his other Coppola film. And then the second of his truly iconic characters, Indiana Jones. So he does Raiders of the Lost Ark. He then, in between Raiders and Temple of Doom, I'm not putting down every single thing he's done.
His early 80s were just
crazy.
On fire.
His, like, almost the entirety of his 80s. Yeah. Like, every year he had just a blockbuster come out.
Yeah.
He does, where was I? So in between his two indie films to come out, he does Return of the Jedi. So yeah, early 80s in particular, real good for him.
Yep.
Then he gets his first and only Oscar nomination for Witness.
Great movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is where he kind of comes into, like, you know, wanting to maybe pursue more dramatic fare. Yeah. Because he does Witness, he does Mosquito Coast, Frantic. He can do comedy. He does Working Girl. He goes back to Indiana Jones. He does Last Crusade, which we also did with Heidi. That was a couple seasons ago, but go check that one out. It's kind of fun to think, though, that we do have other Harrison Ford films to do throughout the 80s. Like, quite a few, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
And now we are moving into the 90s. So, yes, Presumed Innocent, like I said.
Sorry.
We were lobbied hard to do that one, but it is a good movie.
It is. It's excellent.
Excellent. And then he becomes, what's the guy's name that he took over from Alec Baldwin?
Oh, Jack Ryan.
There you go. Yeah. Jack Ryan. So he does Patriot Games. I'm trying to think here. I probably would swing back and forth. But after Han and Indy, I think my favorite, like, role of his is The Fugitive.
Yeah, I could see that.
I love him. Dr. Richard Kimball. He's so good. He's so good in that. So he does The Fugitive. He goes back to Jack Ryan, Clear and Present Danger. We've not talked about it, but it's come up in passing. So he's part of the Sabrina remake, which, as much as I love him, just go see the original.
You're very critical of that remake.
Yeah, I mean, look, it had great actors in it, including him, but the original is fantastic. Yep. Like, just go see the original. Yeah. It's like the same thing we say about 80s movies, where we're like, don't remake it, just watch the original. But anyway.
Yeah.
And here we go. Get off my plane.
Air Force One.
Air Force One. He does Horror, What Lies Beneath.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't do it often, but he did there. And then he comes back to Indy. I know, obviously.
Oh, boy.
A lot of opinions about The Crystal Skull, but he does that.
I watched it again. It is an entertaining enough movie. But when you consider it against the other three.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
Specifically the other two.
Yeah.
Crusade and Raiders.
Yeah.
Yeah. He does Ender's Game. He comes back to Star Wars.
Of course.
And does The Force Awakens.
He's like, I'll come back into this, but you have to kill me.
Yeah. But then we've talked about, like, we've talked about enough times that, like, I don't need to go down that pathway. But, like, due to Carrie Fisher's unexpected passing, he does come back to the franchise basically on her behalf.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was supposed to be her who kind of has this, like, moment with Kylo Ren at the end, and he does it instead.
Good Lord. I would want to watch Kylo Ren kill Princess Leia even less than I wanted to see him kill Han Solo.
That trilogy.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. So he comes back to this franchise, so to speak. He is in, like you said, Blade Runner 2049.
He is, so, yeah. It's a cool scene when they first meet up.
And you're supposed to think that Ryan Gosling's his kid.
I haven't watched it in quite a while. I might watch it this weekend, actually. Yeah.
This podcast also often brings up for you, like, films that you need to watch. So.
This podcast is a great way for me to, like, watch other movies that we would not be able to cover. Yes.
For the podcast.
Yeah.
Up to this point, all films that I've listed for him. But later in his career, he has come to television. So he is part of the Yellowstone universe. He does 1923.
Mm-hmm.
He goes back to comedy. I really want to watch this, Shrinking, with Jason Segel.
Yeah.
So he does that. And then, of course, last summer, Dial of Destiny came out. So.
I just got a question about the Dial of Destiny.
What's that? Are we ever going to watch it?
Are we going to watch it?
I've told you my reasons why I have conflicting feelings about
one day
watching it. Maybe one day. So, okay, so moving on to Rachel, Sean Young.
Yep.
And not the first time we brought up Sean Young.
Really?
So
I can't remember the last time we did.
Oh, you will.
Okay.
So she's very young.
Sean Young.
She was Sean Young in this film. This was only her fourth credit. She is considerably younger than Harrison Ford.
It made the romance
kind of an age gap there, but
it made the romance in this movie even less creepy somehow.
Yeah.
Except it was actually quite creepy. I was uncomfortable.
I did not really dig the quote love story in it. It felt not fully reciprocated on her end. I felt like there was a lot of fear.
He's basically like telling her, tell me to kiss you.
Yeah, tell me to kiss you. Tell me you love me. Tell me you want to be with me.
See, I knew it. You love me.
Yeah. Which, you know, I think what would be interesting here is, like, was that a choice that Scott made? Or, like, I don't know the source material. I never read it. So I have no idea how the relationship is set up.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they were faithful to it or they changed that. So
100% faithful.
100% faithful. Okay. So some of her credits. At some point, we got to do Stripes.
Yeah.
That was even before this. So that was only her second credit. She was very young in that. Young Doctors in Love. So she's in the original Dune.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That movie is a fever dream.
If
the new ones feel like they're kind of out there, the original, wow.
So Wild. The film that we've covered with her already?
Oh, Baby, Secret of the Lost
there
Legend.
There you go, yeah. Nice. And we did that with Chris last summer, so please go check that one out.
Susan Matthews Loomis, no relation to Dr. Loomis.
No relation. She does No Way Out, Wall Street, even Cowgirls Get the Blues, not Fatal Attraction, and not Basic Instinct, and I've said this before,
Fatal Instinct.
Yeah. Fatal Instinct is the film that she is part of. She is an Ace Ventura pet detective. Mm. I just like this title because it's like, oh, that's kind of interesting to think about. Ghosts never sleep.
They don't.
No.
Why would they?
But they also don't always show up, so it's like, what are they doing when
when
they're not showing up for the humans? Anyway. She, for a while, was on the TV show, like the soap opera, The Young and the Restless. Mm, mm. I love this title. My man is a loser.
What a great title.
That's so good.
I like it.
And then Bone Tomahawk.
Oh,
infamously.
No.
Infamously.
Is she really?
Do you remember her in it?
No, I don't. I've pretty successfully purged most of that from my brain.
Probably for the best.
Yeah. All those memories just gone. Like tears and rain.
So I know, like, a general outline of the story of Blade Runner 2049, but I haven't watched it. You have.
Yeah.
So how much is she actually in the film?
Because, I don't remember it all.
Okay. It must be like a flashback because she's dead and actually has been dead.
Yeah.
So it must be like flashback footage or like something. She has a credit for it.
Maybe she left some recordings.
Or maybe it's
for
a
him.
Version of it that, like, I don't know. And then Planet Dune. She is also
Planet
part of.
Dune.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I just thought it was interesting. Okay. So moving on to Rutger Hauer. So, you know, one thing I brought up when we first started watching is, like, how come some people get a surname and some people don't?
No reason.
No reason.
How come they make him in the first place? No reason.
No reason. So he plays Roy Batty. So he is kind of the head of the replicants. I mean, I do think that that's a really interesting storyline, that this, like, group of replicants want to live longer. They're angry. They
Yeah, they're trying to find their creator to get an extension on their longevity because what is it? It capped at like 4 years.
Which is not long at all.
No.
That's real. 4 years goes by real fast.
But, I mean, at that point, they just either like break down or just go insane, right? Mm-hmm. Like they like their ability to handle emotions or situations that a human would be able to get through, they just can't. Mm-hmm. Right. That's why at the beginning, the scene that started this off, we made you the best we could.
Mm-hmm.
And they are pissed about it.
Mm-hmm. So Howard, it's been a couple years. He passed away in 2019. I mentioned earlier in this conversation that like so many of his credits came after 2000 when he was already like in his 50s.
Yeah.
So he really kind of like hit his stride later in his career. Rutger Hauer was a Dutch actor. So much earlier in his career, a lot of like Dutch projects.
Can you list off some of those? Can you say some of those?
No, I'm not. oh my gosh.
No, I wouldn't even try. I'm looking at it right now. I'm like, no, I can't.
Let me see if I can. Oh, I'd have to scroll. The way that IMDb does it, like, I mean, it makes sense.
What about,
like, you have to go to?
Het Jaar van der Kreeft. Who could forget that one?
Who could forget that? Oh my gosh.
Waldreck.
Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah, is that just Rumpelstiltskin in Dutch?
Could be.
I just learned Dutch today.
You just learned Dutch?
Yeah.
Good job. It's a really hard one to get under your belt.
Well, yeah, start with one word.
That's impressive. Is this the one you just said? Het jar. Het jar. So the J is always soft. I don't think there's a hard G sound. So hot jar.
Yeah.
Hot jar van de Kreeft.
Perfect.
So we got that. Oh, here we go. This will be the last one I try. I was like kind of splitting. Which one do I want to try?
Oh, please tell me it's not the one ending in wolf.
That's the one I was looking at too. Voor Koningin en Vanderland.
Yeah. No, I think that's probably 100%. Yeah. I'm not even going to try.
I can say Nederlands, like that's the best I can do
there
for like Netherlands.
Let's just say all of these other titles are from
the Netherlands.
Perfect.
There you go. Okay. So moving into his US work, we have The Osterman Weekend, Lady Hawk, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The Hitcher, which I would like to do that.
Yeah, he's good in that.
Yeah. And then he goes into like into the 90s. We have the film Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
Breeders. I think I have, one notable TV series. Breeders, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, Sin City, Batman Begins.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the TV series is True Blood. So he's in True Blood for a while.
I forgot about that because I've also tried to purge my memory of that.
One of the worst endings of any series.
It just made Dexter's
terrible.
Ending look pretty good.
Why was even the point of her being able to hear his thoughts if they're not going to do anything with it?
My God, let's just move on. Got to move
on. And she should have ended up with Eric. I'm just going to say that now. Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. And then his final credit was a film called Break.
That movie, The City of a Thousand, that was a fun-ish movie. It never really got much traction. It was made, made by the same guy who made The Fifth Element.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. Which
we
were talking about it last night. Fifth Element. Look.
Yeah.
I think it was done in a very respectful homage, and there's a crossover with one of the actors from this film to The Fifth Element.
Yeah, yeah.
But boy, do they pull heavily
stylistically.
From this, yeah.
Yeah, big time.
Big time. Okay, so moving on to Gaff. Gaff is an interesting character because, so Edward James Almost. Right.
Yeah.
Right. I was trying to correct myself.
We have not covered him yet, have we?
No, and we could. We watched a film last year that he's notably in that was really fun to watch, which is very early in his career, Wolfen.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, which we could cover. Because we wanted, I think at the time we were like, well, let's watch all the werewolf movies from the 80s.
What about Wolfen 2? My Stepsister is a Werewolf? Is that the name of that one?
And it's just My Sister.
My sister. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. And it's not Wolfen, it's The Howling, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. God, I'm confused. Okay.
Right. It's easy to do. But yeah, in this film, he's an interesting character because it's clear that he is not a fan of Deckard.
He is a fan of origami.
But we don't get a lot of backstory on like why he has like a chip on his shoulder about Deckard.
I don't think part of me puts it up to like a like cop versus Blade Runner.
Maybe
there's like some, I don't know.
But a Blade Runner is a type of cop, right?
It is, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But Gaff is just like, I don't want to say, but like he's just a cop, right? He's not a Blade Runner.
He's also a part-time flying car pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just an interesting dynamic between the two of them. But so he is in Wolfen, which would be kind of amazing to cover. He is an Oscar-nominated actor, so the film that, like, honestly, probably before Wolfen, we should cover is Stand and Deliver. Yeah. So he's in that. It seems like maybe, I don't know how long the original Miami Vice went, but it looks like he might have been with it for the entirety of the show.
Amazing.
He has, like, over, like, I think 100 episodes for that. So he does that, American Me, Selena, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. So here's, like, courtesy of you, where I also know him from Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, he's great. Commander Adama.
There you go.
Yeah.
You loved that show much more. I don't think I was able to go with it for too long, but I remember him very distinctly from it.
I like the series. Then there was like the prequel series. There may have been like a couple like standalone TV movies, I think. At a certain point, it became a little bit of a chore to try to keep it all together. Mm-hmm. And then the prequel series, I think it was just called Gattaca, maybe?
Well, it looked like via the credits, it's like they attempted to do the show. The show was aborted and then they like rebooted it.
Yeah.
Because there's like a break of a couple years in like, I think the early 2000s where like there is one version of Battlestar Galactica as a TV series and then there's another. And he plays the same character in both.
It does eventually end.
Yeah.
Like there is an ending and the ending is like kind of interesting and also at the same time wildly unsatisfying.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so finishing up his filmography, we have The Green Hornet. He, another notoriously poor ending to a show. He's in Dexter for a while. So
yeah.
He does that.
Yeah.
He also comes back for Blade Runner 2049. He does some voice work. He's in he voices in the film Coco.
Hmm.
More TV work, Mayans MC. And just in general, like, I mean, he has a really long filmography. Actually, everybody else that I'm covering, crazy long filmographies. And the last one, I think maybe has the record for
really?
The longest time. Yeah.
Okay.
Just a lot of TV appearances. So, okay, moving on to Emmett Walsh.
We've covered him several times.
We've covered him once.
Exactly.
No, twice.
Several times.
Three times. Okay, you're more right than I am.
Yes.
You're more right than I am. So my apologies for that. So he's Bryant, which basically like what, police chief?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He there's not a lot of him in the film, but
just him telling Deckard, like, if you're not a cop, you're nothing.
Yeah. He's kind of swarmy. He does feel like he's got
some swarm.
Yeah. So he's still going strong. He is an older actor at this point, 233 acting credits.
Wow.
Yeah. And the last time we covered him was early last year. When we did Ordinary People.
That's what I, yeah.
Yeah, he's the swim coach.
And that's why this movie is the Ordinary People of sci-fi.
Because of him.
Yes.
Okay. So some of his credits, I have, except for his like very last credit for now, all film work. So earlier in his career, Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Hmm. I bring this one up every time I see it. They Might Be Giants. The film.
Mm-hmm.
Love this film. What's Up, Doc?
Yeah.
So, great comedy. Great slapstick comedy. Everybody should go check it out. This one, interesting title. Get to Know Your Rabbit.
Okay.
Serpico. He is in Slapshot. Airport 77. Another, like, some of these titles, it's kind of funny because it's like we can't ever talk about them because they're not 80s films, but they have really interesting titles. The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh.
That one comes up all the goddamn time.
Yes.
That's the one I just got to watch that. I just got to know.
Just got to know.
Yeah.
And I think there's like a handful of like well-known people in it. So The Jerk, we've mentioned Ordinary People. We could do Reds. Oh. Silkwood. Blood Simple would be one I'd be up for doing. He's in Fletch. I'd love to do Critters. Critters would be a great one.
It's like more violent Gremlins.
Yes. A little bit like Gremlins.
Deadlier.
Like, I was going to say on cocaine. Yeah. But anyway. Sure. Back to School, which we just had on TV not that long ago. Raising Arizona is the one also that I missed.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was a while back.
He works with HI in the whatever, like, factory or warehouse they worked in. Yeah.
Harry and the Hendersons.
It's a fun movie.
Yeah. This is not quite a fun movie. The Milagro Beanfield War. Mm. Clean and Sober. Romeo and Juliet. My Best Friend's Wedding. He's in Knives Out. And then we kind of dropped off watching this, but maybe we should get back into it. The Righteous Gemstones.
Yeah, we should. There's just so much time in between the seasons. Yeah, but
that's what kind of.
The last season had like a massive payoff. It was very much worth it.
It was really satisfying. Yeah, yeah. And he is what's his name's dad?
Yeah,
he's like the real patriarch yes. of the Gemstone family. So, okay. Moving on to Daryl Hannah. So she plays Priests. She also, very early in her career, this was also her fourth acting credit. So she has come up before. And I mean, there are other opportunities for us to talk about her in future episodes. But sure. Splash!
That was the one.
That was the one. That was season 3. Love that movie so much.
That was a really fun movie, yeah.
Yeah, it was with Kelsey. Go check that one out. Some of her other credits. I mean, she's such an interesting, they're all interesting characters, whether or not I understand them. Like, she seems a little unhinged from the jump. Like, she's kind of,
in this movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
She's kind of just off. Like, Roy has an objective.
Yeah.
And he is, like, singularly focused on that. Like, we don't get much from Zora. We'll get to that actor in a second. I am kind of curious. Like Priest sticks pretty close to Roy, as does Leon. So why is Zora kind of just doing her own thing?
I don't know, like, why. Other than Roy being, like, I think when they were going through the descriptions, it seemed like he was, like, the most advanced model.
That's true.
Probably giving him the opportunity to kind of like organize something with
yeah.
them.
Yeah. And they do, you know.
But Pris was, I think when they talked about her description, they said that she was like standard pleasure model yeah. for the military.
Yeah.
So if she's like unhinged or like she's gone through,
yeah.
They've all gone through a lot. But she's probably really gone through it.
And they also, if we're strictly talking, that's such a weird way to put this, but like if we're strictly talking from like the way they were built,
yeah,
they probably didn't put much emphasis on like emotional maturity or intelligence or, although like I don't get the sense that she's unintelligent,
yeah.
but that she is.
They're smarter. They're as smart, if not smarter, than the people that built them.
Yeah.
I think that was like part of the crawl in the beginning. But because of their shorter lifespans, like with like Rachel, they had provided these implants to mm-hmm. make her just generally more like stable and able to interact with
she
people.
She could not be more different from
the Chris. Rest of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's just a really interesting character. Then like, yeah, you mentioned it, like the like kind of, I wouldn't call it a glow up, but like what she does to herself physically.
Why'd she?
Like, yeah. But, and then it also seems like her and Roy have a romantic relationship.
Yeah.
Just really interesting little, like really little things that we get to see. It is like what, almost like a 2-hour movie?
It's about 2 hours. Yeah.
I feel like this is indicative of, this is something that came up while we were watching it. I don't think I like said it out loud, but I was thinking like, oh, if this movie, which, okay, there was Blade 2049. So there was a very recent iteration of this mm-hmm. world. But in terms of like pacing, I feel like even though it's almost a two-hour movie, there's some things that we still... This is a common refrain for me where I'm like, we don't see enough of this. We don't see enough of this. It's because of the slower pacing. So, like, we stay in these scenes where overall then we get kind of less information. Like, we are able to, like, linger on in, like, the world and certain kind of aspects of the story. But I feel like films nowadays, the pacing generally is much quicker. Like, you get a much bigger, like... view of the world and the characters, because there's just like they put more into it, I feel, if that makes sense.
We don't know as much about the replicants as we'd want to, but they've also only been around for like what, 3 years and some change. So we know a little bit about like how they were built or what they were intended to do. We know a little bit about Deckard and his history as a Blade Runner, but like so much of this movie is about building this like atmosphere and setting a tone. There's very little explaining what's going on.
But I thought one thing that was really interesting, because this is something that Scott spends a lot of time on, we just see these like city life scenes.
Yeah.
Like we see a lot of what is supposed to be Los Angeles.
In 2019,
yeah. And so in a manner of speaking, like the city becomes as much a character as anybody in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure if like that choice, you know, look, a lot of people really love this movie, so I don't want to like incite pitchforks, but like I feel like the time spent just kind of with these scenes where we see the city life and we see, you know, citizens of the city could have been spent more towards like actual characters that we're following.
Yeah.
But anyway,
I'll read the book and I'll let you know what's going on.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
So we only got through one of her films so far.
All right.
She's in Clan of the Cave Bear, Legal Eagles, Roxanne. Roxanne would be a really fun one to do.
Yeah.
Wall Street, at some point. I don't think you're going to probably be super stoked about it, but we will do Steel Magnolias.
How dare you? So. I can't wait.
She's in that. Crazy People, Grumpy Old Men, as well as Grumpier Old Men. The Little Rascals, My Favorite Martian, A Walk to Remember. So it's kind of interesting because she starts off with like this like really kind of, I don't want to say out there, but like sci-fi film. And then it seems like though overall her filmography is more like maybe, and I don't mean this negatively, but like standard comedy or standard like.
More conventional, like grounded stories.
Yeah, exactly. Did I already mention Walk to Remember? So she's in that. But then she is brought into the whole Kill Bill world.
She is great as Ellie Driver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's in 1 and 2. I guess, I don't know where volume 3 is, if there's going to, because like now at this point, Tarantino's like, number 10 is going to be my last film.
Oh, was there going to be a Kill Bill 3?
I think like there'd been talk about it.
Oh.
So, and then more recently, TV work, the TV series Sense8, and then a mini series called The Now. So of the people that we've covered so far, those are, and that's typically the way that we do follow the characters or talk about them. Like those are the main players,
sure,
so to speak. And now we're getting into like a really, really strong supporting cast. The first of which, William Sanderson. So he's Sebastian. So they come to Sebastian because they become aware that he has worked with Tyrell.
They get to him from the eye guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the eye guy as well. But, I mean, I think it's deliberate that, like, you don't get a lot of... Like, he says to them, like, oh, there's part of me in you. And he, what, uses the term genetic engineering? Is that what he says?
Yeah.
So he works in some capacity with, like, the creation of the replicants. And he knows Tyrell. They have a relationship. So they use him to get to Tyrell. Specifically Pris. Like, she...
Yeah. She, like, plants herself there just so that he will find her. And
yes.
I don't know if they know enough about him and his character, but, like, based on the kind of, like, model of replicant that she is, I'm sure that was strategic, right?
Yeah. I mean, he seems lonely and doesn't seem like he probably gets a lot of attention from women. He talks about this condition that he has where, like, he says he's only 25, but he looks older.
Yeah, his, like, skin particularly looks much older. I mean, he's very sympathetic to...
He is a younger actor in that movie, so they definitely mock him up to look older.
Yeah.
He also, like, literally lives in a house of horrors, as far as I'm concerned. So...
Yeah, it's crazy.
It is really, really creepy. All these other...
The Bradbury
creatures.
Building,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, like, these other creatures that he's created.
Yes.
Like, it's impressive. Like, he's obviously a genius in his own right, mm-hmm. but it is hella creepy. I would not step a fucking foot in his house. No, thank you. So, anyway, the actor, though, William Sanderson, so he is still going strong. But some of his work, I have... A lot of TV work, a couple other notable films. He's in Coal Miner's Daughter. He isn't Fletch, but I don't think we brought him up when we talked about Fletch. Huh. So I don't know how much of a role he has. But probably one of his most notable TV series is Newhart.
Yeah. What was his name?
So
I know his brother's names.
Yeah. He's part of this trio of brothers that do, like, handyman work, so to speak, or they kind of just become comic relief in Newhart, but he is Larry, and has a brother, Daryl, and then he has another brother, Daryl. So, they are. Because I remember watching, when we were watching Blade Runner, I was like, where the fuck do I know this guy? And, like, my dad loved Newhart.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason why I even know of the show, but...
I think everyone's dad loved Newhart.
Yeah, everyone's dad loved Newhart. So, so that's really fun that is. And, like, could not be more different than Blade Runner. Newhart could not be more different.
Very different.
So he's in the film The Rocketeer, Gods and Generals, and then more recent TV work Deadwood, as well as True Blood.
Interesting.
So he's also in True Blood. Okay, so moving on to the actor, Brian James. So he plays Leon. So he's, like, although they all are the muscle, so to speak, he's, like, the most obvious muscle.
He's, like, almost, like, not indestructible.
Right.
But he is as tough as, if not more tough, than Roy.
Yes. Yeah. So... He is another replicant named Leon. So the actor, unfortunately, he passed away pretty young. He passed in 99 at 54. But he was so busy up until the time of his passing. He, at 54 years old, had 177 acting credits.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So some of his other... he did do a lot of TV, but by name I have, like, all films. I thought this was really interesting. Prior to this film... He does a couple remakes of really well-known movies. He does the 1980 remake of The Jazz Singer.
Okay.
And then he does the 81 remake of The Postman Always Rings Twice, which I thought that was interesting. They did those back-to-back. He is in 48 Hours. He also comes back for another 48 Hours.
Okay.
So he's in
Everyone? I assume everyone did.
I don't really know those films so well, so I don't know. Obviously, I know, like, Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte, but... He is in Red Heat, Tango and Cash. I wonder if this is, like, deliberate. So it's not Blade Runner, but he's in a film called Time Runner.
Hmm. Sounds different.
Sounds different, but...
Hmm.
Anyway, he's in Striking Distance, Cabin Boy, The Radioland Murders. And then I mentioned this because I was like, where do I know this guy from? He is in The Fifth Element.
He's the general. He's Bruce Willis's old, like...
Yes.
I don't know.
Like, superior.
Yeah.
Yes. He's the guy towards the beginning of The Fifth Element who comes to recruit Dallas and... Corbin Dallas. And, you know, he doesn't die. Although, like, you kind of think he maybe did die because Corbin puts them in, like, his, like, freezer or refrigerator or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, that's gruesome. But he comes back at the end.
He's okay.
So he, yeah. And then Fifth Element was, like, 97. So he passed away just 2 years later after that. Mm. But he's really good in that. He's great comic relief in that. Like, I like seeing his character that way. Because in this, he's just, like... all kind of frantic aggro energy.
Yeah, I mean, he's actually, like, really good in this, and I think having seen him in The Fifth Element shows, like, some of that range mm-hmm. as far as like I like we recognize the face, but yeah, he played the role of this like slightly like going insane replicant really well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, especially at the beginning, because it opens with him mm-hmm. getting tested, and that's where
he's
you get
super
like a
nervous.
Sense, yeah.
He's asking a lot of questions. The Blade Runner's like, please just comply. Like, you could tell from the jump he's really uncomfortable with the whole situation.
Yeah.
And he's not particularly good. Like, you, even if you go into this movie totally, like, unaware of what this whole world is, you're like, he has something to hide.
Yeah. Yes,
so,
he does.
Yeah. Okay. So, moving on to another actor with, in particular, one really super notable role. So Tyrell, the maker, so to speak.
Mr. Tyrell,
which reminds me so much of, oh my gosh, what's the guy's name? Played by the guy from Memento, the whole alien.
Guy Ritchie?
Yeah. No, not Guy Ritchie. That's the director.
Pierce?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Guy Pierce. So he, I feel like there's like this, like the maker.
Act, yeah.
Maker character. Kind of this like godlike, father-like figure. And so that's who he is in this film.
He's so dismissive to Roy, too. Like, sorry, bro.
Yeah, because he, like, even though he's a genius, but he's like, you're not a human. Like,
I mean,
you're not.
It was it's interesting. And again, I probably am going to read the book to better understand, like, what they're creating in this. Because the other parallel that I think of are, like, the Isaac Asimov books, where there are, like, they're more robotic, but there are these, like, rules or laws that he created that are like literally hardwired into the brains that they create, where they can't either directly or through an action cause or allow a human to be harmed.
It's like Bishop.
Yeah. So like you got a 4-year time frame. You can like put some stuff in here. Maybe think of doing something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe that'd
I mean,
be better than a 4-year lifespan.
The sense that I got from Tyrell is that he is so impressed with himself.
You never even like, considered the possibility that this thing would kill him, right?
What's the line from Jurassic Park?
He was so interested in whether or not he could, he never stopped to think if he should.
Yeah.
More or less the line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's exactly who I feel. Like, he has so much ego about him.
Yeah.
Like, he never thinks that Roy could possibly kill him. He's not, like, afraid until literally Roy is crushing in his skull.
Yeah.
I think he got afraid then. I think he got afraid, but he has such an ego about him. And yes, he's legitimately a genius. He can create these beings that essentially are human.
And owls
and snakes.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know like what the general like world.
Yeah. Why
of,
all these
like,
things have to be fake?
Yeah.
Do we not have owls? Do we not have snakes? Like, anyway,
but he's super good with making the people.
He's super good with making the people. And you know, that takes me back to, like, what I was, like, questioning about at the top of the conversation in terms of, like, why do they have to be so human-like? I think it literally was, like, I want to see just how much, like, how much can I make them like humans with total disregard of the fallout
yeah.
from it. So I don't feel particularly bad for him that he dies. It's gruesome, but I don't really feel bad for him. And I thought it was funny because, you know, we were both laughing about his glasses.
Man,
and I guess like the actor was like so kind of blinded by it, and like also sometimes needed help with some of the like the monologues that he did.
Yeah.
So like the crew had to have
they're like holding it way up at a weird angle.
His dialogue, but he still was having like a really hard time because the glasses were just obstructing his vision so much. He also has passed away. He passed away more recently in 2022. His first credit was all the way back in 1949.
Wow.
So he had been around for a while before this film came along. So some of his credits, again, just a actor who did a ton of television, like one-offs and two-offs and three-offs. But film work, The Killing, Portrait of a Monster, The Sand Pebbles. I thought this was interesting. He does two films that like kind of reference historical events. He's in a film called The St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which infamous
yeah,
in Chicago.
Chicago, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He also does a film called The Hindenburg,
okay.
also infamous tragedy.
The humanity.
Mm-hmm. But probably what most people know him from, a film we have covered.
Yeah, he's the bartender mm-hmm. in The Shining.
He sure is.
Yeah.
Yes. really notable, like, not obviously in the entirety of the film, but great scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
With Jack Nicholson. So, and we did that. That was all the way back in season one, wasn't it?
Was it?
That was like, I think, part of our very first Halloween series.
That was like 15 years ago.
So that, encourage you to go back to that one. And then one of like his, because he, okay, so it's interesting because he kind of quit, it seems, entertainment, even though he still went on to live for like a good 25 years. But the video game of Blade Runner, for which he voiced the same character, that was 97.
Okay.
And that's like his last credit.
Okay.
So, okay, we got two more to go. The other replicant, the final replicant that we follow.
The final replicant.
The final replicant, Zora. I would really love to, again, if you end up reading the book, I would love to know what her relationship is to the other replicants, because she is truly the, like, rogue.
Seems like that, right?
She is never in another scene.
Yeah.
Like
mostly because he killed her.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know to where she's running. Is she running to Roy? Is she just trying to get away?
So the way that she's connected is, like, he finds her because of, like, the scale.
Yes.
That was in Leon's apartment.
Okay. So maybe her and Leon had a thing going on?
So they were all, like, they were interacting in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we never see her with Roy, with Pris, with Leon.
No.
Yeah. So Deckard finds her first.
Mm-hmm.
She's the first replicant, right? First replicant that, because even
he
at that point.
He finds her, and then Leon
becomes aware of her
him.
Death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Joanna Cassidy, still very much working, and again, has another very long filmography, just like all these people. They're all very busy people. So some of her, let's see. Yeah, I have like a mix of TV and film. Early TV series, Buffalo Bill.
Okay.
Not sure if we're referencing the Western figure. I doubt we're referencing the serial killer.
Yeah.
But anyway. She's in that. She is in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Really?
But she plays a character named Dolores.
Hmm.
Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Okay.
So she's in that. Vampire in Brooklyn.
Have not ever seen that. Eddie Murphy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's in Chain Reaction with Keanu Reeves.
Okay.
And now, more recently in her career, besides just like one-offs and two-offs, like she was for a while on Diagnosis Murder.
It's a bad diagnosis.
Yeah, it is a bad
diagnosis. You don't want to get that diagnosis.
Oh, my goodness. Dick Van Dyke, right? He was like the main guy.
Oh, was it? Okay.
I think so. 6 Feet Under, Body of Proof, Odd Mom Out, and most recently NCIS New Orleans.
Okay.
So
fun fact about Joanna Cassidy as Zora.
Yeah.
Because her character was a dancer.
Okay.
She had that snake. That's how he tracked her.
Yeah.
Found his way to her. And she had the snake kind of like around her neck during the scene.
That was crazy.
That was her pet snake, Darling.
Oh, wow.
And that's why she
didn't care.
Yeah, she was totally comfortable with it because it was her own snake.
Wow. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing that I was thinking is like, oh my gosh, all that work to get those rhinestones on her and she's just showering them all off.
Just wiping them all off.
Like, that's what.
How'd you get those put on?
That is meticulous work.
Yeah.
You have to glue each one on separately.
I can only assume that because this is the future of LA in 2019, you just like walk into something and it applies all of
it. It
scans your body, just shoots them all on with lasers, probably, and you're good to go.
Okay. Last actor we are covering, James Hong.
He's awesome.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
But he is awesome, and this is what I was talking about. So I think he just recently finally got his star on the Walk of Fame.
Okay.
He, in this film, plays Chu. So he is...
He's the eye guy. I feel bad for him.
I do, too. And I guess apparently they really did film that in, like, kind of a refrigerated room, so all the actors were legitimately freezing.
Well, especially the replicants, because they had to act like...
They had to act like they were untouched the cold. So he just turned 95.
Amazing.
Years old. That's still amazing. Working. So far, 458 acting credits. I mean, does the guy take a vacation? Like he
he loves to work, apparently.
He loves to work. So, yeah, I don't know who holds the record. I think he might, though. He might hold the record for the most acting credits on IMDb.
Call to action.
Call to action. So, it's been a long time since we've talked about him. Okay, here's the thing. 458 acting credits. I'm sorry, but like...
Okay, we'll take a break and we'll be back for the next 2 hours of this podcast.
Right, exactly. Like, what I am listing, a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of his work.
Yeah.
I tried to just call out the ones that probably most people were most familiar with. But really early in his career, I think I have, like, so one TV series really early that I noted, The New Adventures of Charlie Chan. Mm. He also, though, was in the film The Sand Pebbles. So I think probably as far as film work goes, maybe one of the earlier films that people clock him for is Chinatown.
Yeah.
So he's like Faye Dunaway's butler, I think. The film that we have covered with him, this was all the way back in season one, Big Trouble in Little China.
He's Lo Pan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
both versions.
That was, it had to have been our very first episode with Owen. Mm-hmm. So go check that one out. He is in Vice Versa, Tango and Cash, Wayne Worlds 2, Tank Girl. He is in Bloodsport 2 and 3.
I have not seen those.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with those films.
He's in both those. So he does voice work. He does a lot of voice work. But one of his notable gigs was voice work for the 98 Mulan.
Hmm.
And then he, of course, voices... Of course. In Kung Fu Panda 2, 3, and then coming out. Did it already come out? It's coming out this year.
Yeah, I don't think 4 has come out yet, but it's coming out
soon.
Might
be this month, though.
Coming soon.
Yeah, coming soon. Kung Fu Panda 4. And then, so Kung Fu Panda has become its own franchise.
It sure has.
And so he's done a ton of work with other parts of that franchise.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Like, you know, TV movies and that sort of thing. There's been a couple TV series for which he's also done voice work. One is Kung Fu Panda, The Paws of Destiny, and Kung Fu Panda, The Dragon Knight.
Okay.
So, and then, like, basically he's been on every TV show in the history of TV. So.
for at least one episode. Yeah. No, he's been on, like, everything that you can think of, he's been on at least once.
Yeah.
One episode.
Yeah, he's amazing. Okay. Film synopsis.
What do we got? What could we possibly have for this?
A Blade Runner must pursue and terminate 4 replicants.
That doesn't tell me much.
Yeah, no, I am there with you. 4 replicants who stole a ship in space and have returned to Earth to find their creator.
Okay, so if I start with stole a ship in space and returned to Earth to find their creator, cool. That is mm-hmm. that is what they're... But I don't know what a Blade Runner is.
Yeah.
And I don't know what a replicant is.
Yeah.
I can kind of guess. You know.
So, I mean, that's, I think, the biggest kind of hang up there is that... So the scroll at the beginning of the film...
Yeah.
So replicants have been banned from Earth, correct?
Yeah. I don't know if they were ever necessarily used on the planet, because they were originally, I think, created to, like, support efforts off-world.
Right.
And there was a, like, riot or insurrection mm-hmm. or something that resulted in the loss of human life. And so they were outlawed to ever even be on the planet. I'm assuming that there are exceptions because of Rachel.
Right. That's what I was thinking.
So there must be, like, exceptions to be made. But for the most part, if they're on the planet, they will be hunted down and retired.
I mean, killed. So that begs the question, if they were made in the first place to be off planet.
Yeah.
How busy has Deckard even been? Because, like, are there really that many replicants?
They're all in
around?
L.A.
They're all in L.A. And that's the point. It's like, okay, so they could be anywhere on Earth. So how many replicants are trying to live among humans on Earth that he would have a job keeping him busy enough to hunt them all down? And, like, that's a whole process because it's like – there's nothing visible about them to indicate that they're a replicant. So it's like you have to track these beings down and then get them into like a questioning room, give them this like survey, make the determination that they're a replicant. And then what do? Just like systematically execute them?
Yeah, I think that's what they, I think that's what they would do.
Like, it, look, I'm not trying to, like, I feel like I'm unfortunately sounding the same way that I did about the Terminator, but it's like, just not, I don't want to say like plot holes, but it's like, what is this world where Deckard has had this job? He's been busy enough to have it as his job. He was presumably traumatized from it. We don't ever explicitly are told that.
But he gets the shakes after.
He gets the shakes. That also kind of points towards the argument that he could be a replicant. I mean, it's so interesting because, like...
It did because she had... So he talks about how he gets the shakes, and then when Rachel saves him, and I think she killed Leon, right? Mm-hmm. And she gets the shakes, and it's like, oh, another right. like, similarity between someone that we know is a replicant and someone who, like, they're dropping these crumbs to make us think he might be.
The only thing, though, is, like, you know, the fact that Deckard gets, I mentioned it, he gets totally handled by Leon.
Yeah.
I know you said, well, if he was human, he could just instantly kill him. I feel like he does a pretty good job of beating him up as it is. And I don't think he immediately, like, Leon's objective was not to immediately kill Deckard because he's trying to get information from him.
Yeah.
So.
I think Deckard's, like strength or ability to take a beating. That was something that people have commented on in terms of supporting the fact that he could be a replicant. But I think he's just, like, in an action movie, and he's getting the shit beat out of him. I don't think that really, like, sways me one way or the other. Like, he's like, just barely holding on. And the replicants have, like, essentially superhuman strength. Yes.
And I felt like every time he was, except for, like, Pris. Like, Pris was trying to actually kill him.
Yeah.
But, like, when... Roy is, like, breaking his fingers. Like, that's incredibly painful for him. I will say, though, and this, I chalked it up more to being a movie thing than anything else. Like, the fact that Deckard is able to pull himself up this building, that to me was more like a movie conceit.
That was some real American Ninja Warrior stuff going on.
Yeah, I didn't really take that to mean, like, oh, that's replicant strength that he's able to do that.
Yeah.
That was just, like, a movie thing to me.
Because he tries to, like, jump from one building to the other, and he barely makes it and really misses and is unable to pull himself up. And then Roy just kind of, like, hops across.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like...
And like, even when he, like, you know, takes, like, a metal bat or pole to Roy, you know, Roy's like, that hurt, you know? Like, but it barely does anything to him, really.
Yeah.
So, I guess, if I haven't said it plainly, I want Deckard to be human. That, even though it's really clear that Scott has put in little, pending what version you're watching, you know, put in little clues for him to be a replicant, I want him to be a human. I think that's a better story.
I think so.
I think that's a more interesting story.
That's the actual story.
Yeah. That's that's the actual story.
Yeah.
I think that makes whatever this, like, weird toxic relationship is between him and Rachel more compelling to me.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's more compelling for a human who is, like, learning about and questioning what it means to be a human through what he's learning through these replicants. That is more interesting to me than adding an additional layer of, also, he doesn't even know that he's a replicant too.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need that.
I mean, I think the way that Sean Young portrays Rachel is also really interesting because she arguably is, like, the least human of all of them. Like, she's, like, always really in control of herself for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially at the first meeting with Deckard, like, Roy, and presumably Tyrell says, like, oh, she's, like, the, you know, I'm paraphrasing heavily, but, like, she's the best work that he's done yet.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't even know that she's a replicant. It took, like, what did he say, like, Deckard, like, 100 questions.
Normally takes 20 or 30 or 40 or something. Yeah, so it took three times the amount of time.
Yeah, for him to figure it out. But then what kind of offsets that is, like, oh, that's so interesting that, like, it took that much extra work to determine that she was a replicant, where really she seems the least human of the other replicants. Like, Roy seems way more, like, human than she does.
Well, look, if every awkward person is going to be an android, then we're in trouble.
So
I might be an android.
Or, like, the commercial with what's her face where she's like, are you a robot? Yeah. And she, like, can't prove that she's not. Yeah, it's just, it is to me really similar to Terminator in that, like, look, that just happens a lot with sci-fi, it brings up so many questions because it's like
there are limitations on what you can do. So
based on the reality we know.
Yeah.
So
part of it is accepting like, okay, this is the version of 2019 Los Angeles in the future that they've created, and they don't have time to explain everything to us. Mm-hmm. So thank you. We'll give you this little crawl at the beginning so you kind of understand the basis for the underlying story. But all the little pieces that would bring it together, you're just going to have to like absorb the atmosphere, and whatever you're able to figure out, great.
I guess they give you a lot of room for headcanon.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you got to figure out these things on your own.
Yeah.
So, and
fortunately, there's like 50 versions of the film. So let you do that. I mean, there's only three.
Blade Runner 2049, in a certain manner of speaking, answers a lot of those questions because choices are made, I think, in terms of like who you believe Deckard to be, human or replicant, and, you know, all of that. So,
I think the fact that Deckard exists in 2049 shows that he's, unless he was like the one replicant that never like went through that 4-year cycle or something.
Right.
Like, so that alone.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's explained.
So it's a really fascinating movie. Like, I think that it doesn't like upset me, so to speak, to have all these questions. It's just,
There are a lot of questions. There are a lot of things where like, I'm not sure if that makes sense, but if I'm going to compare it to like some other Ridley Scott sci-fi, it is Blade Runner is
got,
a far more satisfying
no
experience.
Yeah. We're going to go down that path.
Yeah.
If I have to pick a film to pick apart, I'll let Blade Runner be. So,
it's sci-fi, but it's meant to be kind of a thought-provoking sci-fi on what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. So to the extent there are like unanswerable questions in it, and it's just up to you to kind of interpret it however you want, you know, that's something I can do occasionally.
Sure. Call to action.
Yeah.
So one is like way obvious, but I really want to know where people's preference lies.
On Deckard?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm very curious if people are like, no, that's super cool that he's like also probably a replicant, or if they also would rather him be human.
Yeah.
I think it probably also depends on whether or not they have any familiarity with the source material, or if they think that this is an improvement upon the source material.
I'm not going to try to top that.
Okay. And the other one is, is James Hong, does he have the record for the most, anybody tell us that, for the most acting credits?
He's got to.
So if you want to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. You can reach out through Facebook, Instagram, Twitter X, same handle.
Twitter X.
For all three, it is at 80s Montage Pod, and 80s is 80s. Sneak peek.
Yeah. I'm going to need some clues for this one. I was so
focused. Well, okay, so, like, we just came into March.
Mm-hmm.
So the first day of April is
April Fool's Day.
So I am using my leverage as one of the co-hosts of this podcast.
Yeah.
To sneak in another horror film.
April Fool's Day Massacre. Is that a movie?
Well, April Fool's Day.
Is that a movie?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what we're going to cover?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, I am allowing myself to put another horror film in.
Okay.
And I'm super excited about this one. Deborah Foreman.
I've never
and
even...
And a couple other people.
Never seen it.
So, I haven't seen it in its entirety. That's like a lot of... Like, at this point in my life, I've seen, like, YouTube makes it really easy to just, like, find clips of stuff. But I've never seen the whole thing start to finish.
Okay.
So
looking forward to it.
Me too. And in the meantime, just thank you to everybody out there for hanging with us. As always, you have so many podcast choices. So the fact that you are listening to us, and even listening to us at the very end.
If you're still listening.
If you're still listening, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we will talk to you again in 2 weeks' time.